Exams? I'm working on it. I had to travel a bit, and I was waiting on one more exam to be turned in. So I'll grade those this weekend and get them back. Okay, are we live? Okay, great. Thank you. So I want to continue today talking about clustering and the general topic, the general sort of area that we'll talk about is this decision-directed clustering. That's a term used in this textbook for a family of algorithms that essentially do some kind of constrained or hierarchical type of clustering. So because the difference between supervised and unsupervised learning is the presence of labels, it's natural to propose the following: to use prior information to train a classifier, label new data with this classifier, and use the new labeled samples to train a new supervised classifier. So this approach is known as the decision-directed approach to unsupervised learning. And this was something that it's sort of obvious. You could say a heuristic approach at the surface, but it's actually surprisingly effective as long as your initial classifier is reasonable. And this approach has been recently generating some very interesting results in a number of fields, including fields like speech recognition, where we have access now, due to things like the internet, vast amounts of audio data. So the idea is really pretty simple, that if you have a decent recognizer or classifier for your data, let's say the error rate for that classifier is maybe better than 50%, and you label data with that classifier, some percentage of that data is going to be correctly labeled. And then if you do training on that data, you can essentially improve the performance of your classifier, and then you can use that improved performance of the classifier to generate new labeled data. And hopefully now, if the error rate for that new classifier is lower than the previous classifier, with each increment of this process, more and more of your unlabeled data is going to be correctly labeled, and therefore you're going to grow the training set size. Now, the obvious dangers in this approach is that if the initial classifier is not reasonably good, the process can diverge. If your new initial classifier is making certain types of errors consistently, this iterative process is essentially going to reinforce those incorrectly labeled data, and you're going to converge to a solution that's not a very good solution. The tails of the distribution tend not to be modeled well this way, which results in significant overlap between the component densities. So what that statement says is that the other problem with this approach is that the data that the initial classifier gets incorrect, if some of that data comes from aspects of the problem that are, you could say, sort of outliers, or at the very extremes of the distribution, even as you iteratively improve the performance of your classifier, you're never going to actually correctly recognize those outlier tokens, and therefore the algorithm's not going to be able to converge to a solution that's able to learn some of the hard cases that you're having a difficult time recognizing. So the argument against this approach has always been that while you can improve performance on the data that's easy to recognize, you'll never really improve performance on the data that's very, very hard to recognize. And ultimately, when you get into very high performance regions in your problem, the remaining data that's misrecognized is often data that's poorly represented in the training database, and therefore you won't really get beyond the problems. You won't really get beyond. You'll be able to achieve good performance on typical data, But what we often call in information theory atypical data will be very difficult to get good performance on. In practice, this approach works well because it's easy to leverage previous work for the initial classifier. Many of you who work in as graduate students in research will often inherit an existing system, and your job as a graduate student is to improve the performance of that system. So you can use the baseline system that you have as the initial system to label the data. Another advantage of this approach is that it's actually less computationally expensive than the pure Bayesian unsupervised learning approach. So in some sense, this is a more computationally efficient approximation to that. Now, we've talked in this chapter thus far about several clustering methods, and all of those clustering methods are ultimately dependent on how we measure similarity between two samples. And the results that you get are optimal only with respect to the distortion measure that you choose. Now, throughout the course, we've talked about the challenges of measuring the similarity between two samples. What are some of the challenges that we've discussed in this course? Right. So we've talked about things like principal components analysis, linear discriminant analysis, and such. Because we, from a statistical point of view, we often encounter data which has significantly different variances or correlations in particular directions. Similarly, how should we evaluate partitioning of a set of samples into clusters? How should we evaluate the overall quality of a cluster? Should we look for clusters that are very compact, very tight? Should we look for clusters that are very sparse? It's not obvious what constitutes a good cluster or what constitutes a bad cluster for a problem. So we'll talk a little bit about that issue. The answer to both of these questions, though, requires an ability to measure similarity in a way that is meaningful to the problem. For example, in comparing two spectra of a signal for an audio application, we would hope a spectral distance measure compares closely to human perception. We often refer to this as a perceptually meaningful distance measure, and this concept is more general than audio. So, for example, we know that with human hearing, areas of the spectrum that have high amounts of energy are more important to your overall perception of similarity than areas of the spectrum that have lower amounts of energy. So when we compute a distance between two spectra, we weight that distance so that the high energy areas of the spectrum are given more emphasis than the low areas of the spectrum. And that produces what's called a perceptually meaningful distance measure. How do we know that? Well, one of the things you do is you do human experiments and you ask humans to judge what patterns are close to what other patterns, and then you run an experiment with your distance measure, and you show that it's that the results your distance measure is are producing match what humans are doing. And that process of using a distance measure that's produces sort of meaningful comparisons for whatever problem you're working on is very important. And that's why in most fields, you'll find when we compare distances between two vectors or two features, or two feature vectors rather, that we often use some kind of weighting function or some kind of nonlinear mapping or some kind of function that attempts to replicate the properties of the user, whether that be a human, whether that be a machine, whatever the properties of emulate similarity properties of whatever application you're working in. And that's a very important process, and it's extremely important in clustering because the clusters that you get are only going to, are going to be heavily dependent on the distance measure that you use and the distortion measure that you use in deciding what data points should go in what clusters and that kind of thing. Now, we've talked about the fact that principal components can be used to achieve invariance prior to clustering through normalization. And it's often common that people will, before you do clustering, people will actually do some kind of principal components analysis or some kind of linear discriminant analysis, or to embed that in, as or to make that part of the distance measure. We've also talked about a broad class of metrics, which in a general form is known as the Minkowski metric. And the Minkowski metric is essentially just a generalization of Euclidean distance, where we take the distance between two vectors and raise it to a power. So for the Euclidean distance, we take the sum of the squares and then take the square root. But there's no reason we could not set Q to something higher than 2. The higher we make Q, the more we're going to let large distances dominate the overall calculation. So if you get a nominal result for Q is equal to 2, if you set Q is equal to 4, the clustering produced by Q is equal to 4 will be much more concerned about data points that are very far apart, because the distance is basically getting raised to the fourth power instead of the second power. So if you cluster data, a typical data set where there's, you know, a bit of confusion between the classes, and you cluster that data with different values of Q, you will get different cluster arrangements. And again, whichever one is right or wrong depends on how relevant that distance measure is to your problem. Another non-metric approach is sort of a non-Euclidean distance type metric, measures the angle between two vectors. And here we show an example of how to do that by taking the dot product between the two vectors and dividing it by the norms of the vectors. So it's essentially measuring the angle between two vectors. And in some problem space, the angle between two vectors might be more important than the actual distance. It's sort of funny that I'm talking about this, actually, because on the podium when I came in this morning, there's this paper, and I don't know where this came from, but it says, discriminating nuclear threats from benign sources in gamma ray spectra using a spectral comparison ratio method. Okay, nice journal paper here. Now, what's wrong with this paper? I haven't even read the paper, but I can tell you already what's wrong with this paper. And I don't know, I hope this isn't anyone in this class. No, it came out of Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington. Discriminating nuclear threats from benign sources in gamma ray spectra using a spectral comparison ratio method. And I can tell you that what they're going to do in this paper is they're going to show you how this spectral comparison ratio method gives them a very good error rate, very low error rate on a classification problem. So having sat through about, you know, a large percentage of this class, how many different papers like this could you probably generate now? At least an infinite number. Why? And how, well, you, right, but I mean, so you could do that. So obviously the point here is that you're classifying nuclear threats from a spectral comparison ratio, right? Now, you've learned in this course many, many different measures, distance measures, many, and you could easily substitute any of those in here. You could also substitute, they're essentially using a likelihood ratio here, so you could substitute different learning machines and things. But what's the important question? When I see a title like this, what's the first thing that pops into my mind based on this slide? So why spectral comparison ratio when it comes to classification of nuclear threats? Okay, but even if you don't know what spectral comparison ratio is, what should you be thinking when we talk about perceptually meaningful distance measures and the importance of them? So suppose that paper said principal components analysis. You read the paper, they get 0.7% error. What does that mean? What does that mean tell you? It doesn't tell you much. Because the real question that paper, and I'm not meaning to pick on the paper, I just think it's kind of funny that that was sitting on the podium today. The real question that the paper needs to address, or that it needs to convince me of as a reviewer, is this spectral comparison ratio relevant to the problem of assessing nuclear threats? Is there some physical or some meaningful basis for using such a measure? Because there's many different measures I can use, and they'll all give good performance, some better than others, but they'll all generally give similar types of performance. And I can create infinite numbers of variations of those by varying parameters of these models in this. But the real question is that measure relevant to the problem? Now, when we compare distances in audio applications, we use distance measures that are based on human perception. And that's important because ultimately, the processing that you're doing is for an end user who is a human. When we talk about things like cell phones, for example, and you talk about the speech compression algorithms that are used in cell phones, every bit that's transmitted over the channel is very important in that application because you're trying to transmit the speech signal with as little information as possible. And every bit of that representation has been optimized for a metric that matches how humans perceive audio quality. So that the algorithm that's used actually uses a code book. And the entries in that code book are derived at using a clustering process somewhat similar to what we talked about with k-means. It's actually a little bit more sophisticated, but the point is that when they do that clustering, they're using a distance measure that matches human perception. So, you know, when the day comes when you're standing up for your thesis defense and you say, well, you know, I'm working on data set XYZ and I got 3% error using my brother's distance measure. The question isn't going to be, you know, just saying, well, I got better performance with that. That's not really what the important question is. The important question is, to what extent does that distance measure capture the things in your problem space that are important? Important to the users or important to the system or you know, whatever. And that's I think, a really critical issue that's often overlooked with these things. It's very easy to invent distance measures that do something reasonable. But the good distance measures most of the time reflect the constraints of the real application and the real users of those systems. Now, the next thing we need to think about is, well, all similar, as with the distance measure, there are many different criteria we can use for clustering. One of the most straightforward is to choose the center of a cluster as simply the arithmetic average or the mean of the feature vectors assigned to that cluster. And then to use an error measure that's simply reflective of the sum of the mean squared error of all the elements in the cluster and then summed over all the clusters. So this is essentially algorithms like k-means will attempt to minimize the mean squared error as measured across the entire data set. But that's not the only criterion that can be used. And if I change that criterion, I will get a different clustering set. So, for example, another criterion that's used is the minimum variance criterion. And in the minimum variance criterion, the overall distortion function is measured as a weighted sum of the variances of each one of the clusters. And so here we're weighting essentially those variances by the number of elements in each one of the clusters. And then within a cluster, the overall distortion measure is a function of the variance in the cluster. Now, what this does, you'll notice that there's no mean appearing here. What this essentially does for the cluster is it takes all points in the cluster two at a time, and it computes the distances between those points. So that's what this S of X prime represents. So instead of So if we have a cluster, this first measure, the mean, is essentially going to take the center of the cluster and it's going to sum the distances of all the data points from that center. This variance metric is essentially going to take the distances between all two points at a time, and it's going to compute the overall variance or the quality of that cluster as the sum of these pairwise variances. Now, that's one of the reasons this is done is because that gives you a measure of how compact this cluster is. If the cluster is very compact, the metric will be low. If the cluster is very sparse, the metric will be large. We've also talked about the concept of a scatter matrix. We've introduced this with linear discriminant analysis, and there are clustering techniques based on that kind of a metric. There's also clustering techniques that are based on the trace of the scatter matrix. There are clusters that are based, there's approaches that are based on the determinant of the scatter matrix. And then there are a whole nother family of clustering approaches that are based on the eigenvalues of the scatter matrix. And the reason this is done is to try to arrive at a clustering that's independent of any linear transformation. It's essentially trying to develop an invariant type distance. So in this case, this term you may remember from linear discriminant analysis, but we essentially use a distortion criterion which is related to a product of the inverses of the eigenvalues. And that's kind of an interesting measure because it will be invariant to any linear transformation of the data. So we've talked about the distance measure, we've talked about similarity measures. Now let's talk about the optimization process. Because the sample set is finite, clustering can be viewed as a problem solved by exhaustive enumeration. However, computational complexity of this approach is prohibitive. If C is the number of clusters, you can argue that the computational complexity of this approach is proportional to the number of clusters raised to the nth power divided by the number of clusters raised to factorial power. And that can be a very large number. There's actually a number of computational issues associated with clustering. Clustering of small amounts of data, 1,000 points, 10,000 points, is not a big deal. But clustering of large amounts of data, billions of points, is a big deal. Now, if you think about that, there are many applications where we attempt to cluster billions and trillions of things. In fact, search engines do this all the time. Search engines try to build databases of similarities between web pages. If you've ever wondered how, you know, how Google search works, when you search for a web page, it comes up with alternate pages that are similar to the page you're looking for. Now, if you've ever thought about how that works, if you have a trillion web pages, how are you going to compute the pages that are close to the page that's the top hit? Every time you search, is it going to search all of those trillion pages, compute a distance, and return the top so many pages? No, obviously it can't, because that would take too much compute power. On the other hand, is it going to store the similarity between between two pages for every combination of two pages in the database? Well, that would be 1 trillion times 1 trillion entries. That would be too much memory. So clustering is a challenge when you're working with very large data sets, because you have to balance memory and computational costs. And you never have enough memory to keep a similarity matrix between all vectors, which would make it really easy then to compute distances by simply looking up the similarity between two vectors in that matrix. And you can't afford, on the other hand, to compute the distances on the fly, because then you're doing an enormous number of Euclidean distance computations, or enormous number of distance computations in the clustering process. So, and then on top of all that, if you want to find the optimal clustering, you could in theory do an exhaustive search of all possible ways the data could be clustered. So for example, if you had 4 data points, you can think about all the different permutations of 4 data points taken, let's say, 2 at a time. Or taken if you're clustering 4 data points into 2 classes. Well, if you have 100,000 data points, all possible ways you could cluster 100,000 data points into, let's say, 100 clusters, that's a very large number. So you cannot simply do an exhaustive search. So we typically, with clustering, use an iterative hill-climbing procedure. We've seen this with k-means. We generate an initial clustering. We randomly select a point. We test whether assigning it to another cluster will reduce the error, and we iterate until no further reassignments are made. So what this is suggesting is an iterative approach where you have an initial clustering, and then you can essentially take all the data points and determine whether moving one of those data points from one cluster to another will result in a better clustering, and then you can essentially iterate on that. So this is a single point variant of the k-means process, where you have an initial clustering, you take a data point, you test whether that data point would be better assigned to another cluster, and then you go back and you iterate. So with k-means, we do this across all data points in one iteration. This is a simpler approach that operates one point at a time. Now, efficient methods exist for updating the cluster means and overall error, because we need only consider the contribution from this one point. This can be considered a sequential form of the k-means algorithm. The obvious drawbacks include the potential to get stuck in a local minimum or local minima. One way around this is to use a hybrid approach to alternate between this and standard k-means, and people have invented a number of variants of this process. But this is a process that you might think about using if you were trying to cluster trillions of points and your goal was not so much to assign all of those points to the right classes, but your goal was to find out what the most reasonable clusters were. So you can take a set of clusters and iterate a little bit point by point just to see if you can refine those clusters a bit. Now, another variant of this kind of an iterative algorithm is what we call hierarchical clustering. We seek a clustering technique that imposes a hierarchical structure on the data, much like a decision tree. So let us consider a sequence of partitions of n samples into C clusters. So we start at the top level with our data points, and what we would like to end up with at the very bottom is essentially a single cluster. So you can think of the top as a situation where every data point belongs to its own cluster, one data point per cluster. And instead of going, remember with k-means, we went from the top down. We started with all the data in a cluster, and then we kind of worked our way down. This is the opposite approach. You start with all of the data in its own cluster, and then you work to essentially merge those clusters so that you can, end up with one cluster, but doing that in a bottom-up fashion where with each level, you essentially reduce the number of clusters by one. So in the first partition, there are n clusters, each with one sample. In the next partition, there are n minus 1 clusters. At level k, there are n minus k plus 1 clusters. If two samples in a cluster at level k remain in the same cluster for higher levels, the clustering technique is referred to as a hierarchical clustering. This graphical representation of the process shown to the right here is known as a dendrogram. Similarity values can be used to help determine whether groupings are natural or forced. If the values are comparable across a level, then there is probably no strong argument for any particular clustering of the algorithm. Now, what do you think is the benefit of this graph once you've built this graph? This is essentially a graphical representation of a clustering. Exactly. I mean, this takes your data and it essentially self-organizes it so that it's easy to tell which data are similar and which data are dissimilar. And you can then, if you remember when we talked about decision trees, if you have attributes associated with each one of these data points, you can then make inferences about what attributes of those data points are important in determining their similarity. Another value of this approach is that this graph gives you it gives you a set of clusterings from one cluster or all the way out to n clusters. So you get all the intermediate results doing it this way versus k-means where we had to pick a number of clusters and then do the clustering. Now, the dendrogram is the case where you have, where you're essentially merging clusters step by step. You could actually think of a more general form of this as an interconnected graph where data points are, as you reduce the number of clusters, the data points are allowed to associate with different clusters, and then you can redraw this as some kind of interconnected graph. So what's another interesting thing about this is it shows you how you can view clustering as essentially a graphical process. And then there are many graphical algorithms that you can apply to cluster data, essentially. And you can also use Venn diagrams to depict relationships between clusters, because when you've done this now, you have a very clear relationship. You know that this cluster is built out of these two things which are close and this thing which is presumably close to those. But you have some kind of relationship about how the clusters compare in terms of the data points associated with them. But in this particular approach, the sets are disjoint, meaning that when you look at clusters at a given level, they will have no data points in common. So this is also a hard decision-based clustering. So there's a sort of a variant of this known as agglomerative clustering. Hierarchical clustering is very popular as an unsupervised clustering method. There's two distinct approaches, agglomerative or bottom-up and divisive top-down. The well-known Lin-Buzo-Gray algorithm, which we talked about previously and we demonstrated last class, is considered a divisive clustering algorithm, meaning that with the LBG algorithm, we start at the top with all the data in one cluster, and then we split each cluster in half with each step in the algorithm. So we go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16. With the agglomerative approaches, we start with everything in one class, every data point in its own class, and we work our way down to one cluster. So we actually can, in the process, produce solutions from N all the way down to 1. Agglomerative clustering typically requires less computation to go from one level to the next because you're simply going to merge two clusters. You're only going to do one merging of two clusters into one, and that computation is local. Divisive clustering requires less computation if the goal is a small number of clusters. If the number of clusters is much, much smaller than the number of data points. And that's why in the early days when we were trying to cluster large amounts of data on very small computers, the LBG algorithm became very popular. And you'll still see that used today because it's very attractive for situations where you have very large amounts of data, but your goal is to produce very small numbers of clusters. Here we list the pseudocode for an agglomerative hierarchical clustering algorithm. And as you can see, sort of the core step is to merge a cluster at each step of the iteration. So with each step of the iteration, you're going to reduce the number of clusters by 1, and to do that, you're going to have to look at all clusters, all current clusters, and decide which two are the best to merge. So you have to find the two nearest or two most similar clusters and merge them at each step. And that's essentially how we produce these dendrograms. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure MATLAB has a function for this. And MATLAB has functions for other types of clustering as well. With agglomerative clustering algorithms, it's common to use minimum variance type distance measures. And that's a little bit different than global variance in that this kind of a distance measure is going to compute the distance between two clusters as the minimum of the distance between any two points in those clusters. So if I have cluster A and cluster B, you might think about a distance measure. You know, you might say, well, an obvious distance measure is to simply use the distance between the means of those clusters as representative of the distance between those two clusters. Because in agglomerative clustering, we have to decide which of these clusters are closest to one another. Now, what's the measure for doing that? Well, you might say, let's simply take the mean of this cluster and the mean of this cluster, compute the distance between those means, and use that as the distance between those two clusters. Now, what's wrong with that? there's nothing, you know, technically wrong with that. It's a reasonable approach. But you could imagine a situation where you have two clusters like this. And the means might lead you to believe that those clusters are far apart. But the fact that there's overlap in these clusters might lead you to want to assume that these clusters are very close. So an alternate distance measure is to look at the minimum of the distance between one point in this cluster and one point in this cluster. And if you search over all points in both clusters, you can find the two data points that are closest to each other, and you can use that as the distance. So in this case, the distance between those two clusters will be very small because there's overlap here, whereas if you use the mean, the distance between these two clusters would be very large. Not surprisingly, you could also invert that and say that the distance could be the maximum distance between any two points. Or the distance could be the average distance between any two points. Or the distance could be the distance of the means. When dmin is used, this is referred to as a nearest neighbor cluster algorithm. The computational complexity of agglomerative clustering can be summarized here. We need to calculate n times n minus 1 interpoint distances, and each of those calculations is proportional to the length of the feature vector. And we need to store those in a table which requires O of n squared in memory. Finding the minimum distance pair requires stepping through the entire list. So the overall complexity of this approach is proportional to n times n minus 1, where n is the number of data points, times d plus 1, which where d is the dimension of the vector, or O of n squared d. And in general, you can actually say that this is proportional also to the number of clusters, C. So you can write the complexity as O of C n squared d. Now, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with a complexity that's related to the square of the number of data points that you have? If you have a lot of data points, that's essentially a quadratic or an exponentially growing complexity. So for a large number of data points, you're going to have a problem. There are faster implementations of these approach. Memory becomes a big bottleneck for these kinds of clustering techniques, and therefore you'll see clustering software designed to operate on very, very large amounts of data actually has to take into account things like intelligent disk caching strategies and such, because you're going to have to figure out a way to store and to access very large numbers of sets of distance values between the data. So for example, if you try to cluster, let's say your computer has a couple gigabytes of memory, and you want to cluster a trillion data points, which is not a reasonable thing to do in today's world. Well, the problem that you're going to have is you could actually write a very simple algorithm that stores a trillion by trillion matrix. And you could actually do this if you had enough, if you had a disk farm to support the cache. But what's going to be the problem as you start to access elements in that matrix? What's going to be the problem from a computer or computational point of view? Right, so you've got this big matrix, and you're writing code to access elements of that matrix. Code's very simple. You say A of I, comma J. I goes from 1 to a trillion. J goes from 1 to a trillion. As you step through that matrix, what's your computer actually going to be doing? if your computer has a couple gigabytes of memory and this matrix is 1 trillion by 1 trillion in dimension. Disk. Because the memory for that matrix is going to ultimately be stored in your cache on disk. Now, what do you know about algorithms? What's your experience with algorithms that run out of internal memory or ones that use the disk space to cache? How would you compare the time it takes for such algorithms to run? Orders of magnitude slower to go out to the disk cache. Further, if the disk cache is, if the data is stored sort of in a random way on the disk cache, you're going to spend a lot of time kind of randomly accessing the disk cache. Whereas if you can create some kind of caching scheme where when you go out to disk, you bring in a chunk of numbers and keep those in internal memory, and then you work out of internal memory for a while, then you go out to cache and bring in another chunk of numbers, that kind of an algorithm will be much better, much more efficient. So there are, you know, people have worked extensively on algorithms to try to allow you to cluster large amounts of data without doing so much disk caching, because disk caching slows your algorithm down by orders of magnitude. And that's why the incremental algorithms we discussed earlier are sometimes preferred for very, very large data sets, because those, with those kinds of algorithms, you can control the amount of caching, the number of cache accesses you're doing. Now, another view of this whole area of clustering is what are called spanning trees. In a single linkage algorithm, the clustering algorithm is terminated when the distance between the nearest clusters exceeds an arbitrary threshold. A spanning tree is a tree with any path from one node to any other node, but no cycles or closed loops. A minimum spanning tree is a spanning tree with a minimal number of edges, which you can obtain by using a minimum distance criterion. So what this is suggesting is that it is possible to create, you can actually think of the clustering process as a graph theory problem where you connect, where you have edges that connect two data points that are considered similar. And you can then use graphical methods to manipulate that graph to find, for example, the minimal number of edges, which can describe the data in some kind of clustering scheme. So here's sort of a general optimal hierarchical clustering algorithm where we essentially iterate by finding clusters whose merger changes the criterion least, and then we merge those clusters. So that's sort of what we discussed previously, but you can achieve this kind of a result using this concept of a spanning tree looking at the problem as a graph theory problem where you've got all these edges, you've got this connection, all your data is connected with some graph, and your goal is to minimize, to transform that graph, either to minimize the number of edges or to minimize the complexity of the graph. And there are a family of clustering algorithms that kind of work on that principle. So we went through some examples last time, so I won't do those today. But you've got the applet. In the applet, you've got the ability to do Euclidean distance-based clustering, k-means clustering, and the LBG clustering. So you can look at, for the same data set, you can look at the difference that those three algorithms give you and the difference in error rates and things like that for those kinds of classifications. So what we've done in this section of the course is to essentially introduce you to clustering from a general point of view. We talked about both maximum likelihood and Bayesian approaches to clustering. We compared supervised versus unsupervised learning for that clustering. And then we developed a number of clustering techniques based on different similarity measures, criterion functions, and optimization techniques. And you've got now another tool in your bag of tricks which can be used to classify data. You can take data, do the clustering, and then use the clustering as the class assignments. And then you can classify new data using those clusters and those class assignments. So this is an unsupervised technique to do pattern recognition. And as such, it's the first sort of truly unsupervised technique we've talked about in class. Okay. So I will see you on Monday.